Today, the world just changed. The DFA Daily to the 15th of April 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The IMF has said that the world has changed dramatically in the past 3 months. A rare disaster, the virus, has resulted in the tragically large number of human lives being lost. As countries implement necessary quarantines and social distancing practices to contain the pandemic, the world has been put into a great lockdown. The magnitude and speed of collapse in activity that has followed, they say, is unlike anything experienced in our lifetimes. They said this is a crisis like no other, and there is substantial uncertainty about its impact on people's lives and livelihoods. A lot depends on the trajectory of the virus, the effectiveness of containment measures, and the development of therapeutics and vaccines, all of which are hard to predict. In addition, many countries now face multiple crises, a health crisis, a financial crisis, and a collapse in commodity prices which interact in complex ways. Policymakers are providing unprecedented support to households, firms, and financial markets, and while this is crucial for a strong recovery, there is considerable uncertainty about what the economic landscape will look like when we emerge from the lockdown. So they assume the pandemic and required containment will peak in the second quarter for most countries in the world and then recede in the second half of the year. I have to say, though, these are pretty heroic assumptions. I hope they're right. And they stress that several economies entered this crisis in a vulnerable state with sluggish growth and high levels of debt already. That sounds familiar for Australia, doesn't it? So in their April World Economic Outlook, they project global growth in 2020 will fall down -3%, a serious downgrade of 6.3 percentage points from January 2020. This makes the Great Lockdown the worst recession since the Great Depression and far worse than the global financial crisis. Assuming the pandemic fades in the second half of 2020 and that policy actions taken around the world are effective in preventing widespread firm bankruptcies, extended job losses, and system-wide financial strains, they project global growth in 2021 to rebound to 5.8%. And this recovery in 2021 is only partial, as the level of economic activity is projected to remain below the level that they projected for 2021 before the virus hit. The cumulative losses to global GDP over 2020 and 2021 from the crisis could be around $9 trillion. And that's greater than the economies of Japan and Germany combined. For the first time since the Great Depression, both advanced economies and emerging markets and developing economies are in recession. For this year, growth in advanced economies are now projected at -6.1%, emerging markets and developing economies with normal growth levels well above advanced economies are also projected to have negative growth rates of -1% in 2020 and -2.2% if you exclude China. Income per capita is projected to shrink for over 170 countries. Both advanced economies and emerging market and developing economies are expected to partially recover in 2021, in line with their assumptions. But in their alternative severe scenario, when the pandemic hangs around in the second half of this year, leading to a longer duration of containment, worsening financial conditions and further breakdowns of global supply chains, they estimate that global GDP could fall even further, an additional 3% in 2020, if the pandemic is more protracted this year. While if the pandemic continues into 2021, it may fall next year by an additional 8% compared to their baseline scenario. And turning to Australia, the IMF says that Australia was entering its first recession in nearly 30 years. And the IMF, though, sees strong recovery in 2021, which would leave annual economic output smaller than in 2019 and the jobless rate elevated at 9% next year. Factors such as Australia's relatively tight containment measures against the virus, the economy's dependence on commodities and tourism exports, and already high levels of household debt underpin the large projected contraction in economic growth. Now, one point to make is that they did their modelling before the latest round of government support was introduced, so things may shade slightly better, but it's bad nevertheless. But consider this. Harvard University professor Mark Lipschitz warns that the virus may not be contained during 2020. He's authored a research paper which notes that the virus may continue to flare up for a number of years if a vaccine or an effective treatment is not developed. The paper, which has been published in Science, the journal, concludes that social distancing measures may need to be reinstated intermittently over the next few years unless the virus is completely eradicated. The authors note that it is uncertain as to how long immunity from the virus will last. As The Guardian reported, one scenario predicted a resurgence could occur as far out in the future as 2025 in the absence of a vaccine or effective treatment. Mark Lipschitz, a professor of epidemiology at Harvard and co-author of the study, said infections spread when there are two things, infected people and susceptible people. Unless there's a large amount of herd immunity than we're aware of, the majority of the population is still susceptible. Predicting the end of the pandemic in the summer of 2020 is not consistent with what we know about the spread of infections. In its daily briefings, the US government has not outlined plans beyond the current restrictions, but the latest paper adds to a building scientific consensus that physical distancing may be required for a lot longer in order to keep numbers within hospitals' crucial care capacity. Then again, if immunity is permanent, the virus could disappear for 5 or more years after the first outbreak, the paper suggests. If people have immunity for about a year, as is seen for some other circulating coronaviruses, an annual outbreak would be the most likely outcome. So unless we get a good vaccine, and scientists have yet to develop a vaccine even for the 2003 SARS coronavirus, this is going to have a long, long tail. In which case, the IMF modelling is simply too optimistic. And as Zero Hedge reported, China might be in for another surge in reinfections. Of course, that's the last thing the global economy needs, bearing in mind the shutdown everywhere but in China. According to Kaysen, China could see another surge in coronavirus infections starting in November, one of the country's highest profile medical experts has said, as low numbers of new cases prompt governments nationwide to get people back to work. While countries may be able to bring the deadly pandemic under adequate control by autumn, the coming winter may bring a second wave of infections in China and elsewhere, said Zhang Weihong, who heads Shanghai's COVID-19 clinical expert team and directs the infectious disease departments at one of the city's top hospitals. Zhang's comments come as Chinese officials gradually ease quarantine restrictions as part of efforts to revive the country's economy. The East Asian nation, where the previously unknown virus was first detected last year, has seen numbers of daily new cases fall in recent weeks after recording thousands of deaths and rolling out unprecedented lockdowns. Speaking on Saturday during an online live stream broadcast, Zhang said that Chinese experience with disease control means any resurgence in infections later this year will be manageable and will not require a repeat of the dramatic measures taken to curb the virus's initial spread. China won't implement any shutdowns, and imported cases will certainly still make up the bulk of the outbreak, Zhang said. In recent weeks, Beijing has begun reporting that infected people travelling into China have made up the vast majority of the country's new confirmed cases. Of course, Beijing has not been reporting that there were several more thousand mysterious cases appearing in Wuhan than the official deaths. So frankly, when it comes to Chinese data, it's all a bit of a mess. Like other public health experts, Zhang expects that in the long term, countries will have to take a flexible approach to recurring outbreaks. For a long time, epidemic prevention and control will go through periods of relaxation and tightening. It will be possible to live and work normally, but it probably won't be possible to completely eradicate the outbreaks, he said. That means that countries must continue to fight the pandemic together, even after their initial domestic outbreaks have peaked. Only when all nations have properly controlled the disease will we be able to live well again. And it wasn't clear just how China would fight its next pandemic without shutting down the entire nation, when that's precisely what China did back in February, and the result has been a historic surge in defaults and delinquencies, which Beijing has yet to address even as China's economy fails to reboot. Aggressive testing and contact tracing, combined with immediate hospitalization of confirmed cases, is the secret to effective epidemic control, Zhang said, perhaps unaware that China did none of those things and simply dragged the sick away to some unknown place while putting down whole towns and provinces under complete lockdown. But what may be the most troubling of all is that if China indeed suffers its next wave in November, that is right around the time when Morgan Stanley predicted the US will be hit by a second wave of the virus as well. And according to BOFA's latest fund manager survey, a second more powerful and economically crippling wave of infections, similar to the ones observed during the Spanish flu, is now the biggest tail risk facing investors. So this ain't over till it's over. And locally, the ABS reported on recent arrivals to Australia. Overseas arrivals and departure statistics are international travel movements of persons arriving in and departing from Australia with a focus on short-term trips, less than 1 year. It is the number of international border crossings rather than number of people. The trend estimates, in fact, have been suspended from February 2020 for all short-term visa arrivals and short-term resident returns due to the impact of the pandemic on international travel. But in February 2020, seasonally adjusted estimates for short-term trips, overseas visitor arrivals to Australia decreased 12.5% since the previous month to 647,000 trips. And Australian resident returns from overseas decreased 2.9% from the previous month to 928,500 trips. And of all arrivals to Australia travelling on an international student visa in February 2020, there was a decrease of 62,590, down 34% for students compared to the same month of the previous year. The higher education sector dropped with 61,400 fewer students, down 41%. The school sector, 2,100 fewer students, or down 43%. And the postgraduate research sector with 560 fewer students, or 12% less. So just another lens on the impact of the virus. And the Westpac Melbourne Institute Consumer Confidence Survey recorded the biggest fall in the 47-year history of the survey, bringing the index down to levels last seen during recessions. Household sentiment plummeted 17.7% to 75.6 in April as governments instituted widespread restrictions to stem the spread of the virus, shutting down large tracts of the economy. The confidence survey was based on 1,200 adults across Australia in the week of April 6 to the 11th. This is the biggest single monthly decline in the 47-year history of the survey, taking the index below GFC lows to levels only seen during the deep recessions of the early 1990s, when it got to 64.6, and early 1980s, when it was at 75.5. However, it's important to note that the lows in previous recessions were reached after 1 or 2 years of continuous deterioration, compared to the one-month collapse that we've seen here. Certainly, Westpac cannot rule out the index dropping below the historic low of 64.6 that we saw in November 1990. The details of the survey are all very disturbing and reflects the large shocks to jobs and spending. However, the most surprising message is the collapse in confidence in the housing market, they say. Well, frankly, I'm not surprised. Sentiment around housing collapsed in April, with assessments of both time to buy and price expectations plunging to the most negative levels since the 2008 financial crisis, Westpac said. The drop was consistent across all major states. Consumer expectations for home price falls were even sharper. The Westpac Melbourne Institute Index of House Price Expectations dropped by over half, down 50.8% to just 69.7 in April. And while this measure has a much shorter survey history, the fall is nearly four times bigger than the largest monthly decline since they started running the question regularly from 2009. Despite this, the Economy Next 5 years sub-index was down only 3.8% in the month, and at 87, they say, is still comfortably above recent cyclical lows. So that's all right then. And Domain reported that buyers of off-the-plan apartments are beginning to bear the brunt of the COVID-19-led economic downturn, with some struggling to settle on properties bought at the height of the market. According to a range of industry sources, some are now scrambling to secure finance, others are trying to find new vendors, and some are even walking away altogether in order to avoid bigger long-term losses. In one worst-case scenario, a buyer who paid a deposit on an off-the-plan apartment valued at $646,000 in Melbourne 18 months ago was recently informed that it was now only worth $500,000, or a 15% fall in value. And more off-the-plan buyers who are scheduled to settle in coming weeks could find their valuations fall short of initial expectations set 18 months ago as the economic fallout deepens. And conveyancers are highlighting that buyers who contracted 18 months ago are now facing changed circumstances. People lost their jobs, clients had pulled out money from their super, they were $40,000 short of what they expected to have on settlement in some cases. The buyer doesn't want to commit to this contract, but equally doesn't want to lose their deposit. A lot of developments will extend sunset clauses, and we'll see that in 12 to 18 months because of delays in material arriving from overseas. And in addition, from broken glass on balconies and sliding doors to facade panels hanging off buildings and blocked toilets, apartment owners and their managers are putting lives and the health of residents at risk by cancelling repairs and maintenance works because of the virus crisis. Many apartment dwellers mistakenly believe that tradies weren't allowed to work on apartment buildings under the current restrictions, but such tasks all fall under essential services and so indeed are permitted. Tradies who work in the strata industry are reporting that remediation work to dangerously dilapidated facades and replacing broken glass in balconies and sliding doors are among the critical jobs that are currently being cancelled or postponed. And talking of postponements, ASIC has deferred several of their activities relating to mortgages and loans. While ASIC commenced a review of lender responses to consumer experiencing financial difficulty last year by commissioning consumer research that examines the experience of consumers engaging with credit providers about their financial difficulties, the regulator has said it will now defer the next stage of the work until the 30th September 2020. Instead, ASIC will actively engage with stakeholders on financial difficulty, in particular around hardship requests resulting from the virus. The learning from our work to date will inform our stakeholder engagement, ASIC said. For its scoping review of residential mortgage guarantees and co-debtor loans, ASIC has said it will continue to monitor developments and analyse the information it's already received, but it will be deferring the collection of further data for the purpose of this work. And likewise, ASIC has said it will continue its analysis of the pilot data received for its collection of recurrent mortgage data, which aims to help ASIC identify trends and systemic practices in Australia's home lending markets, which could have the potential to cause significant consumer detriment. But it is deferring its industry engagement activities until further notice. And the regulator has also confirmed that it will continue to receive and assess applications for credit licences, Australian financial services licences and audit-related professional regulations, and is seeking additional information on how applicants will manage their obligations due to the changed operating environment in the light of the virus. Commenting on the changes, ASIC Chair James Shipton said ASIC recognises that participants in the Australian financial services sector are under enormous strain due to the effects, and we also acknowledge that they are taking special measures to support their customers who are adversely affected. We expect them to continue to act fairly and in the best interest of consumers in these extraordinary times. And Australian Broker reported that lenders have continued to be named as participants in the SME guarantee scheme following its official commencement at the end of last week. In its first round of approvals, the government has indicated it plans to make offers of participation to 29 banks and 5 non-bank lenders. The scheme allows lenders to provide SMEs new unsecured loans of up to $250,000, which have a 50% guarantee from the government, enabling them to be offered more cheaply and more freely as compared to ordinary business loans. While 2 non-banks yesterday announced that they joined the ranks of those offering the unsecured funding, neither lender was able to confirm their stance on broker commissions for the new loans. At this point, some scheme participants, such as NAB, have said there will be no broker commissions paid on loans written under the scheme, while others, such as Liberty, will pay an upfront commission of 0.45% of the approved amount, but no trail. Online small business lender Prosper has received access to the scheme to help small businesses deal with the impact of the virus over the next 6 months, and Prosper has received an allocation of up to $223 million under the scheme, which can be applied to all eligible new lines of credit and loans issued between the 14th of April and the 30th of September 2020. And FinTech Moola has also been selected as one of the 5 non-bank lenders to participate in the scheme, with its proprietary technology enabling the group to approve loans within hours. Speed of decisioning is critical in how Moola can serve SMEs in this rapidly changing climate, said their CEO. The lender has indicated that it will not be able to confirm the commission structure for brokers until funds become available. So standing back, people are still scrambling to try and deal with this horrible crisis that we're in the middle of. And the more modelling is done, frankly, the more uncertainty there is about how long this is going to play out and what the long-term economic consequences are. But certainly my own modelling suggests that this is not going to be a V-shaped recovery. It might be a U-shaped recovery. That would not be a bad outcome. But it could also be an L-shaped recovery, meaning that after the recent falls, we grind along the bottom for a long, long time. Well, we'll see as more data comes in how this plays out. But I come back to my main point that until such time as the virus is under control one way or the other, all bets are really off about the future economic performance of our local economy, to say nothing of the global economy and the markets. And finally, before I go, here are just a few updates from the market. So the ASX 200 closed down 0.39% to 5,466. The financial sectors index was down 0.09%. to 4,352, and the S&P ASX 200 futures was down 0.78% to 5,455. The Aussie US dollar was down 1.29% to 63.57, but has certainly climbed back from its recent lows, and that's partly because of a slightly weaker dollar. And the euro Aussie dollar was up 1.2% to 1.7242. The 2-year bond was down 2.77% to 0.225. The 10-year bond was down 1.83% to 0.907. And the gold Aussie cross was up 1.14% to 2,700, while the Bitcoin Aussie cross was up 1.94% to 10,913. In US terms, gold was down 1.54% to 1,741. WT oil was up 0.7% to 2026. Bitcoin was up 0.27% to 6,891, and the S&P 500 futures was down 0.72% to 2,822, while the Nasdaq futures was down 0.36% to 8,661. And with regard to future market performance, it all goes back to what's going to happen in the real economy. I still think the markets are rather optimistic relative to what I'm seeing in the real world, so I wouldn't be surprised still to see more market falls ahead. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.